From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile.
One person who is a little bit drunk, and he's with his wife, and when he see me, he say, "You are terrorist." But I told them that I am Sikh, I am Indian, I am not terrorist.
Afghan, Asian, Sikh Indian, Latino and Arab taxi drivers talk about hate crimes on the road. Also, how many people are unaccounted for at the World Trade Center? Families of undocumented workers are afraid to come forward to claim they're dead. And while all eyes are trained on Bin Laden, U.S. and British special forces are already in Afghanistan, and they're not looking for Osama. The chief European correspondent at the Christian Science Monitor uncovers the story. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now in Exile's War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Washington Post is reporting today the U.S. Army has sent more than 1,000 light infantry troops to the former Soviet republics of Uzbekistan and Tajikistan in a military buildup near Afghanistan to try to flush out Osama bin Laden. It said the soldiers from the 10th Mountain Division based near Syracuse, New York, would provide ground security for any searches and rescues of downed U.S. pilots in Afghanistan and also aid special forces. The troops' deployment in Central Asia marks the first time regular U.S. Army forces have gone on a mission in the former Soviet Republic. Aircraft carriers, more than 300 warplanes, ships armed with cruise missiles, and special forces troops have gathered within striking range of Afghanistan. Uzbekistan is one of the stops on Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld's current tour of the Middle East and Central Asia. Uzbekistan, which borders Afghanistan to the north, agreed Monday to open its airspace to U.S. military operations against possible targets across the border. And the Washington Post is also reporting the CIA secretly trained about 60 Pakistani intelligence officers to capture or kill Osama bin Laden in 1999. The operation was arranged by then-Pakistani Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif and his chief of intelligence with the Clinton administration. In turn, the United States promised to lift sanctions on Pakistan and provide an economic aid package. This, the Post reported on its website last night. Sharif was ousted in a military coup, and the plan was shelved later that year. The plan was set in motion less than 12 months after U.S. cruise missile strikes against bin Laden's training camps in Afghanistan that Clinton administration officials believe narrowly missed hitting the exiled Saudi militant. The clandestine operation was part of a more aggressive effort by the United States to get bin Laden than has been previously reported, including consideration of broader military actions such as massive bombing raids and special forces assaults. Afghanistan's ruling Taliban said last night they're ready to negotiate with Washington about turning over Osama bin Laden to a third country, apparently in an effort to avert a military attack by the United States and its allies. Afghanistan's ambassador to Pakistan, Abdul Salam Zayef, repeated the Taliban's longstanding position that bin Laden would not be turned over without proof that he was involved in the attacks in the United States. But he added what sounded like a desperate appeal for negotiations. President Bush has vowed repeatedly not to negotiate with the Taliban for the surrender of bin Laden. And the U.S. Senate yesterday voted overwhelmingly to pass a $345 billion defense authorization bill, which includes President Bush's demands for flexibility on ballistic missile defense. Democratic senators dropped provisions that Republicans and the White House felt would have limited the president's authority to withdraw from the 1972 ABM treaty and constrain the development and deployment of space-based weapons and ballistic missile defense. President Bush yesterday backed the creation of a Palestinian state as part of his vision for Mideast peace as he tried to rally Arab and Muslim nations for war. It's the first time President Bush has publicly backed a Palestinian state since taking office, although he took pains to say the first step must be reducing Mideast violence. Bush's talk of Palestinian statehood comes as he sends Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld to four key Muslim states, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Oman, and Uzbekistan. And among the U.S. Special Operations Forces massing along the border of Afghanistan are psychological operations specialists. The 193rd PSYOPS Wing in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania has been deployed. The Air National Guard unit flies six EC-130E commando solo aircraft, which are airborne broadcast stations that can monitor and jam electronic transmissions. The planes are probably in Uzbekistan or Tajikistan. Analysts say it's almost certain that soldiers from the 4th PSYOPS group at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, which operates commando solo radio and TV equipment, have been sent to the region. The group's 1,200 active duty members are among 5,000 PSYOPS soldiers in the Army. Thousands of supporters of Afghanistan's Taliban rulers marched through the streets of the Pakistan border city of Quetta yesterday, denouncing President Bush as a terrorist and Pakistan's military ruler, General Pervez Musharraf, as a traitor. The rally started as a welcome for Fazlur Rahman, head of Pakistan's radical Jamiat Ulema Islam, who returned to Quetta after a nationwide tour. The JUI is a populist Islamic movement that founded the Taliban among refugees from neighboring Afghanistan. And Iran's defense minister Monday warned the U.S. that it would confront any of its planes that penetrated Iranian airspace during possible strikes on Afghanistan. Iran made it clear early in the crisis it would not give the U.S. any military support or join George Bush's coalition. It insists any action must be taken under United Nations auspices. Iran's position blocks the direct route to Afghanistan for U.S. planes flying from the Turkish base at Incirlik. But the U.S. has many other potential flight paths from carriers in the Gulf and Indian Ocean. And the United States may have to sacrifice the death penalty if it wants to extradite and try suspected terrorists arrested in Europe. Within a month, European Union leaders will meet with top U.S. officials to hammer out streamlined extradition procedures. But most EU countries will likely oppose the extradition accords as long as the United States retains the death penalty. New World, Prince, Emancipation, here on Democracy Now in Exile's War and Peace Report. As we break the sound barrier just blocks from where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood. NATO yesterday claimed the U.S. had provided clear and compelling proof that Osama bin Laden and his al-Qaeda network were linked to the September 11th attacks. In response, the alliance announced it's ready to fight with the U.S. in an attack on Afghanistan. But Secretary of State Colin Powell, in an interview with the New York Times, called the evidence only pretty good information and said it's not evidence in the form of a court case. The spokesman for the Pakistan Foreign Ministry says the United States has not provided conclusive proof. The Taliban announced last night it's willing to negotiate with Washington about turning over bin Laden and reiterated its request for proof that bin Laden was involved with the attacks. But while all eyes are trained on bin Laden, U.S. and British special forces are already in Afghanistan, and they're not looking for the Saudi militant. Rather, they are, Peter Ford writes in the Christian Science Monitor, looking for traditional military targets, according to former special forces soldiers familiar with the sort of operation now underway against suspected terrorist bases in Afghanistan. Peter Ford is chief European correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. He joins us from Paris. Welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Hello.
It's good to have you with us. So can you explain what is happening in Afghanistan right now with these U.S. and British forces?
Well, nobody knows exactly how many there are, but they operate, these sorts of special forces operate in small teams as small as four men. They're designed to operate secretly, independently, behind enemy lines, and basically do reconnaissance. And what they're likely to be doing now, according to the sort of people who've done this job in the past in other parts of the world, is just that, is covert reconnaissance surveillance, they call it, looking for the sorts of targets that might be hit later. They think it's most unlikely that these soldiers will be looking for Osama bin Laden himself, because that's not their job. Trying to find a bin Laden requires intelligence and espionage skills, which is not what these men are into. These men don't make contact at all with anybody behind enemy lines, and if they can't talk to anybody, which of course would give their presence away, they can't gather intelligence about bin Laden.
Can you talk about what traditional military targets are?
Well, in Afghanistan, they're few and far between, because there's really not very much left there that one might hit. I mean, you don't have huge army bases, you don't have telecation centers, you don't have the sorts of targets that the Allies went after in Iraq, for example. They will probably be looking for training camps where Osama bin Laden's men are suspected to have been training, although I think it's perhaps unlikely they'll find many of the men left there anymore. They'll be looking for satellite dishes. As one man put it to me, they'll be looking for any occupied target that provides something human to go after.
How did you get this information?
I talked to former SAS people who've done operations like this, most recently in Iraq, but also in Oman, where the SAS, which is the British elite force, fought for many years on behalf of the Sultan of Oman against Marxist guerrillas. And there, the territory is very similar, and the tasks are very similar to the ones that are faced in Afghanistan.
We're talking to Peter Ford of the Christian Science Monitor in Paris. Can you talk about how these SAS, Special Air Service, British forces, and Delta soldiers operate?
Well, they operate in extreme secrecy. Delta is very closely modeled on the SAS. In fact, SAS men trained Delta in the early 70s when it was formed. They're not the sorts of special forces that are commonly referred to in the States, which include Rangers and far larger groups of soldiers who operate in larger numbers out of helicopters. They're very air mobile. And Delta and SAS do obviously drop in helicopters if they need to, but they work far more closely, close to the ground. They blend in. They blended well enough that in Iraq, for example, when they were operating in army Land Rovers to get across the huge distances that they had to cover, they would sometimes just tag on to the end of Iraqi army convoys and were never spotted. They're that good at pretending they're not there. They stay normally, though, out of contact with anybody. They move at night. They lie up during the day and get a little bit of sleep, but also keep their eyes open on the targets. They can communicate with the headquarters through radios. They can also communicate with strike aircraft that might be called in, because once they've identified targets, they can then act as forward air controllers, telling the airplanes or the pilots exactly where to hit. They're equipped with laser markers now as well, which help strike aircraft hit their targets. And they're trained to do the sorts of things that ordinary soldiers aren't, in a fairly quiet and brutal fashion.
You know, it's interesting. There's a piece in the Financial Times today, "New Theater of War Will Be Tough for the Media to Track. Much of the conflict may be highly secretive." Certainly what you're laying out with these special forces in Afghanistan, but not exactly what the president in this country can rally the public around if, as he says, covert operations may be secret even in success. And so it sort of goes to the second point of bombing some, you know, very obvious targets so that that video can be played over and over again on television.
Well, you're certainly not going to have pools of accredited journalists being helicoptered into Afghanistan with the special forces, that's for sure. This, of course, is only the first phase in this war. There were secret soldiers like this behind Iraqi lines long before the war itself broke out in 1991, and, of course, the press weren't with them in those days either. nor did we know anything about their activities until after the war when some of the soldiers began to talk about them. But clearly, this is not going to be the sort of war where reporters can go along with the troops just behind the lines and file dispatches to a pool. It's going to be a much more secret affair than that, and we're really going to have the army and the government's word for what happened, I think.
Peter Ford, you also did a large cover story called "Why Do They Hate Us?" You were using the quote of President Bush when he addressed Congress, a question you wrote that has ached in America's heart for the past 2 weeks. Why did those 19 men choose to wreck the icons of U.S. military and economic power? And you talked to people from around the world, Arabs and Muslims, retired Pakistani Air Commodore Sajjad Haider, a friend of the U.S. who understands why they hate us, as the headline went. Also, an Egyptian-born cleric, U.S. enemy Abu Hamza al-Masri. Can you talk about these interviews and what you were trying to convey and get at?
Well, when Mr. Bush asked a question in his speech to the joint session, he said that why do they hate us? He asked. He said they hate our freedoms. So I thought it was worth testing that against opinion in the Middle East and the wider Muslim world. And I must say that most of the answers I got did not tend to support Mr. Bush's view. The general feeling is that the hatred expressed by the people who perpetrated the attack on the 11th of September was the sharp end, if you like, the most extreme form of a much more generalized resentment against U.S. policy in the Middle East. Specifically, I think, U.S. policy in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, because the vast majority of Muslims are sympathetic to the Palestinians, and they do not think that the United States has been equitable or fair-minded in its approach to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So they see America standing four square behind Israel, and thus America becomes, by extension, the same sort of enemy as Israel is. Now, of course, very, very few Arabs or Muslims take that attitude as far as Osama bin Laden does. And there are other focuses of resentment as well. There's a good deal of sympathy, too, in the Arab world for Iraqi civilians and the way they have suffered from the sanctions that have been imposed ever since before the Gulf War. And indeed, from the bombings, which UK and US aircraft carry out on a fairly regular basis, although they're not very widely publicized. There's also in the Gulf, I think, a good deal of resentment against the United States about the presence of U.S. soldiers. Osama bin Laden regards that as what he calls a pollution of the holy sites, Mecca and Medina in Saudi Arabia. Again, that is an extreme expression of an opinion, but the opinion is quite widely shared. So that when Osama bin Laden, if he is behind the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, when he does something like that, it's not that very many people in the Arab Muslim world support it, but they do understand where he's coming from, because the sorts of buttons that he presses, the sort of causes that he espouses, are causes that resonate in Arab and Muslim minds.
We're talking to Peter Ford, chief European correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. He's speaking to us from Paris. I've actually got a couple of questions for you on that, another issue just being in Paris yourself. But first, why do you think U.S. officials and also just the American people in general find it so difficult to, or are so unwilling to, acknowledge any legitimacy for the resentment? Although I would say American people, there might be a lot more understanding than officials.
Well, no, I think you're right. I mean, I've certainly got that impression from the responses to the article that we published last week. The overwhelming number of responses I've had have been very positive. I think it's hard for Americans to... I don't think it's so much that they deny the legitimacy of these grievances or resentment. It's that they're not very aware of it. I think Americans think of themselves, and generally quite rightly, as a generous people and a just people. They really hear about these sorts of grievances, and I think it takes them by surprise. I mean, why American officials are less ready to deal with it, obviously had to do with long-standing U.S. policy in the region and the way successive American administrations have seen their strategic interests in oil and in the Middle East generally. Although, of course, I think we're seeing signs just this week that there's a certain amount of rethinking going on with President Bush's announcement that he was on the verge of announcing support for a Palestinian state before September the 11th. And this, of course, is brand new. I mean, the Republican Party has never supported a Palestinian state. But I think it is sinking in Washington and elsewhere, that if the United States wants Arab and Muslim countries to join the coalition against terrorism, those countries have to see some interest for them in doing so. They have to believe that if they join America in what it regards as a just war, America will join them in finding what they see as a just solution to the Middle East crisis.
You've got an interesting timeline on the bottom of the piece that you did in the Christian Science Monitor, 50 years of U.S. policy in the Middle East, 1947 to 48, U.N. votes to partition Palestine into two states, one for Jews, one for Arabs. Arab states invade, 300,000 Palestinians flee Jewish-controlled areas, Jewish forces prevail, declaring Israeli independence, U.S. recognizes Israel. 1953, CIA helps Iran's military stage a coup, deposing the elected leader Mossadegh, whom the U.S. saw as a communist threat, and instead installed Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi as ruler of Iran. Then 56, Israel attacks Egypt for control of the Suez Canal. 1960, Iran, Iraq, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Venezuela form OPEC. 66, U.S. sells its first jet bombers to Israel, breaking a 56 decision not to sell arms to the Jewish state. And then 1967, the Six-Day War, Israel launches preemptive strike against Arab neighbors, capturing Jerusalem, Sinai, Gaza, Golan Heights. Kuwait and Iraq cut oil supplies to U.S., and the U.N. adopts Resolution 242, calling on Israel to withdraw from the captured territory. Israel refuses. Christian Science Monitor does a different kind of coverage than the rest of the U.S. media.
Well, what we're here for is to try and increase understanding amongst our readers of parts of the world and sorts of people with whom they're not familiar. I think we get the chance often, in especially in stories like this, for which we broke open in the 6 pages of the newspaper, to go into considerable depth, and also yes, to give voice to people who don't always get much of a hearing in the United States and whose points of view are not well understood. And I think it's particularly important at the moment that those points of view are understood in the United States, especially in light of the danger, which I think is perhaps less great now than it was perhaps 2 weeks ago. But at a certain stage, I think there was a very grave danger that the war against terrorism was going to degenerate into a clash of civilizations, a sort of a Christian good against Muslim evil. And that, I think, could drag the world down into some very, very dangerous depths indeed.
Last question. That's a news headline we read today, and that is European countries unlikely to extradite terrorist suspects to the United States if the U.S. doesn't waive the death penalty, which no European country agrees with. How significant is that in France, where you are?
Well, opposition to the death penalty in the United States is very strong in France. It always has been, and I don't think the new war on terrorism is going to change that. Whether a man is a suspected terrorist or a suspected murderer makes no difference to European view that the death penalty is a fundamental violation of the right to life. I think it's going to cause problems for the United States in extraditing suspected terrorists, because I think it's very unlikely that the United States or the states that have the death penalty will abrogate it, and there's certainly no chance at all that Europe will extradite anybody unless either the death penalty is abrogated or a specific undertaking is given that the person who is extradited does not face the death penalty. That's happened before. There was an American citizen who was extradited recently from France who was wanted for murder in the United States, and he was extradited only when the law was changed in the and that the prosecution agreed not to seek the death penalty.
Peter Ford, I want to thank you for being with us, Chief European Correspondent of the Christian Science Monitor, based in Paris. And you are listening to Democracy Now! in Exile's War and Peace Report. When we come back, we'll speak with New York City cab drivers about hate crimes on the roads. You are listening to an unprecedented collaboration of independent media, Pacifica affiliate stations around the country, radio, community radio, then public access television. We're broadcasting on MNN, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, which is public access in New York, channel 34 today. We are also broadcasting on CUNY, borough-wide television, which is public access, channel 75 in New York, and on Dish Network, channel 9415. That's Free Speech TV, FSTV. And if you have a Dish, you can see this program throughout the day. On the internet as well, you can hear us at WBIX.org twice a day, as well as our archive shows. You can hear any of them throughout the day and over the last weeks as we do this War and Peace teaching for however long it takes. You can hear us at webactive.org. And you can go to our own website at democracynow.org. And a very special welcome to the listeners of WFMU in New Jersey and throughout New York who have just joined this week at 91.1 FM. You can hear us every day in the New York area at 7 p.m. Monday through Friday. You're listening to the War and Peace Report. Back with the taxi drivers in a minute.
أشهد أن محمدا رسول الله
You're listening to the Democracy Now! in Exile's War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. One young Afghan man was beaten so severely in London, he's paralyzed from the neck down. An Asian man was assaulted and had blue paint poured over him and his car. A young Sikh Indian man from Seattle was screamed at, punched, and had tufts of his beard pulled out. Two people from the Bronx have had their cars set on fire. Many others all over New York have been assaulted or harassed. These people are all victims of hate crimes in the wake of September 11th, and they're also cab drivers. Over 60% of New York City's cab drivers are of Arab, South Asian, or North African descent. Thousands have stayed off the job for fear of attack. We first go to the roads of New York.
He was on 52nd Street between 2nd and 3rd Avenue. And 9:30, the lady, she's sitting on the back car. She was old lady. She saw driver, I lost my glasses. So my brother, he's actually my brother. His name is Surinder Singh Jolly, model number 2L55. And he turned her back like that. And he turned like back to look at her glass, find two glass in the back seat. In the meantime, somebody shoot from this glass and the bullet went to other side of the glass.
That incident happened 52nd between 2nd and 3rd last night, 9:30 p.m. in midtown heart of New York City, one block away from the police precinct.
Monday, one person who is a little bit drunk, and he's with his wife, and when he see me, he say, "You are terrorist." But I told them that I am Sikh, I am Indian, I am not terrorist.
One night when I left the cab, you know, at my neighborhood in Queens, the like two young guy and one girl, they calling me like Bin Laden, you know.
Window of my home is broken, and I guess somebody broke it because he or she thought I was not the Native American, maybe. I heard a few words from different people. You know, once I was traveling on a train, and somebody looking at my face said, "Animal." I think that was the worst, and I think it justifies a little bit because people were angry. You know, maybe they don't know a lot. That's why they think everybody who has a face of Asian or who looks like Arab is terrorist. But I guess it's natural that they get angry because their country was attacked.
Yeah, the guy just come close to my window and I crack the window and say, "You ready to go back to your country?" That's all I say.
I won't blame them too much, but since this is a, you know, civilized city, educated people, they should think before they do anything. I felt the same pain because I'm living here for half of my life, you know, and I'm part of this city and this country and this community. I'm affected just like everybody else, I guess. You feel the same way I feel.
I'm Muslim, but Islam does not teach that. This is not Islam. It's not Islam. This is clearly a terrorism. So, because Islam is a religion of peace.
We love peace and we want to stay together, you know.
That piece, interviews with cab drivers in their cars throughout New York, was produced by Rob Weiss. And you are listening to the War and Peace Report in our studio at the firehouse of Engine 31 in Chinatown, just blocks from where the World Trade Center towers once stood. We're joined by three people. Bhairavi Desai is a staff organizer with the New York City Taxi Workers Alliance. Luis Molina is a cab driver in New York and on the organizing committee of the alliance. And Irfam Nayab is a Pakistani cab driver in New York. Irfam Nayab, let's start with you. How has it been driving since September 11th, and where were you on the day of the attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon?
That day I was in the city near the World Trade Center, and I'm still a little scared to drive in the city. I heard a lot of stories from my friend. I took the week off after this attack, but I'm still very nervous to drive in the city.
Did you actually see the towers come down?
No, I was like 10 blocks away at that time.
Did you understand what was happening?
Yeah. Because my radio was on and I heard that towers are going down. Planes hit to the towers.
So did you start to go uptown?
Yeah, but that time traffic was blocked, so everybody was stuck. You can't go anywhere at that time.
Mm-hmm. And what has it been like for you since? There have been the huge attacks on the Trade Center, where you have perhaps 6,000, more than 6,000 people dead. But then we have reports increasingly of attacks on people of South Asian descent, or those who people think are South Asian. What's happened to you? Have you had any problems?
Well, I'm from Pakistan. I do have some problems in my neighborhood. There were some attacks reported in the Islamic Center, and I'm still nervous. I'm just trying to stay at home most of the time.
Bharavi Desai, you work with a lot of taxi cab drivers, though you don't drive a cab yourself. Can you talk about what you've heard over the last few weeks?
Sure. As you know, your report mentioned in the beginning, there were two cabs that we know of that were burnt down, that were set on fire in the Bronx on the night of the 11th. We know of several cabs, over 9 of them to be exact, which in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn, who all had their windows broken and the cars were vandalized, overnight. We know of several drivers who have had passersby hailing them, pretending to be passengers, and then when the windows roll down, the passerby will spit into the driver's face. And over the weekend, I was at the airport talking to drivers, and a Latino brother who just come back from the city told me that a gang of people were just holding on to the door, not wanting to let him move, calling him a terrorist. So there have been attacks on, whole range of levels.
And how are taxi drivers organizing to protect themselves?
Well, the Taxi Workers Alliance has been distributing, safety tips to give out to drivers based on what we're learning from these different incidences. So we've been advising drivers to keep their front windows up, to keep the partition closed, to keep the front doors locked. So one of the other things that happened during the first week, the week of the 11th, was as drivers were standing at the red light, people ran up to the cars, opened up the front door and dragged them out and would beat them. Now, a lot of these incidences have not been reported widely with the police precincts. Mainly, I think, as Irfan mentioned, there's a high level of fear out there, given that 90% of this workforce is immigrants, and actually it's about 75% of them that are either South Asian, who are mostly Muslims or Sikhs, or Arab or North African Muslims. So it's an overwhelming majority of drivers who've been impacted. The 25% of drivers who are not part of directly of these different constituencies have talked about just, xenophobic attacks. A lot of African drivers have talked about being told to go back to their country. Again, people being called names. Drivers have also had the problem of actually being refused themselves, that when a passenger is hailing them and they drive up to the person looks at their face and just walks away. We'll call them a name and then walk away. Or they get into the back seat and when they see it's a Muslim name, then they walk out of the cab. So,
is it true that cab drivers are taking their nameplates off of the back so that you can't see their name?
Well, some people are turning it around, mm-hmm. right, out of fear. And I think that they'll kind of gauge the passenger. And if it seems that, somebody who's not going to harm them, then they'll turn it back around.
There was an organizing meeting a few weeks ago right after the attacks. But when the attacks on individual South Asians were increasing, where a man talked about carrying an American flag everywhere as protection. And I was in a cab recently where I was speaking with a Muslim man. He had a big American flag taped to the back of his cab. And I asked him about it. And clearly he had put it up for protection. Mm-hmm. Is that something you're finding?
Oh, definitely. I mean, both for protection and I think also, it's been coercion out on the streets, It's been out on the streets that most of the flags have been sold. So I know of incidences where passengers have walked into the cab and said to the driver, where's your flag? And has insisted that the person have a flag or they're going to walk out of the cab.
Now, Luis Molina, you're a Latino cab driver. Have you been the victim of any kind of hate crimes or attacks?
Not yet, but I hope not to be by the grace of God. But I have come close to a few belligerent passengers. One male Caucasian passenger I picked up from Penn Station, and he told me his destination, where he wanted to go. And then as we were talking, then he mentioned something about the topic about the World Trade tragedy, where he happens to work. and the subject was about, you know, having access. And I said, you know, it's kind of hard to get through that area. And he says he has no problem getting through it because all he has to do is show the badge and they allow the cab to go through. And then he talked about, you know, that the United States should bomb Afghanistan. And I said to him, you know, war is hell. And he says, you know, well, you know, they killed our people, and we have to do vengeance. You know, something to that effect. And I was beginning to become very uncomfortable in the ride as I was going down 33rd between 10 and 11 as I was heading towards the West Side Highway, you know, to take him to his destination. And then we started to talk about, you know, war and how there's no winners and losers in the wars. And I mentioned, you know, I've had some Vietnam veteran passengers in my cabin. They've told me their side of the story. And it's not a very pretty picture in the foxhole. And he was saying, you know, well, I have an international degree or something in international affairs. And he said, you know, that there's some veterans in the Vietnam War that would agree with him that we have to go in there, do some justice. And I said, but that's war is hell. You know, that doesn't make it. And who are you going to find? I mean, this is a very, the terrorist organization is almost like an invisible organization. How do you fight an invisible organization? And he started to get upset with me, and he would violently close my partition. And he said that he didn't want to hear anything of what I had to say, you know. And, you know, he was very belligerent. So I took it upon myself to reopen the partition to remind him that he's in my cab, and that if he doesn't agree with anything that I say, he's welcome to leave the cab, because he was starting to become disorderly. And in the rule book that it says, somewhere in the taxi cab rule book, you know, we are to pick up passengers who are members of the orderly member of the public, as it is so stated in the taxi, because I have my yellow rule book with me. In this case, he became very disorderly, and I had to just simply put him out of the cab because of the fact that he was becoming very belligerent, and I felt a very threatening presence. And it was on my premonition that I just had to put him out of the cab. In spite of the fact that the meter was reading like 6 and change, I lost money. And I got stuck in traffic as well with the EMS workers and fire workers that had everything blocked off. And I couldn't go through 12th and 34th to go to my destination anyway. So it took me about maybe 15 to 20 minutes to head back to Penn Station.
Do you find that people will try to find out if you're Pakistani or Indian or Afghan?
They ask me these racist questions from my perspective almost every day, and you know I get this, you know, from time to time. They don't even know what flag I put it in the front, what it looks like. I say, what flag is that? Is that the American flag? Because they don't read, because it's a Puerto Rican flag, and the words Puerto Rico is written on top. If I had the Ladish flag, they would probably take it for a flag from Pakistan. Who knows? You know. But
do you see yourself as a teacher on the roads of New York,
unfortunately,
talking to people about bigotry? And
unfortunately, it seems like that's my role right now. And since I have a bachelor's degree, and you know, I don't really have to drive a cab, because I can do other things. I have educational background. I finished college back in 88. I mean, you know, some people would say to me, well, you chose this profession by choice. That's true. But there was something else that I found in this job. And this job is valuable in teaching me lifetime skills of interpersonal relationships with people and meeting people of different cultures, and to have an understanding of where people are, even if you meet them in the streets. As I say, you know, about the drivers, you know, they're all my brothers. And I'm not ashamed to say that.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves. You're listening to Democracy Now! in Exile's War and Peace Report. We're just blocks from Ground Zero. We'll be back in a minute.
Well, enough said about that. Still got to get up in the morning. Still gotta get up in the morning. Still gotta get up. Oh, you may be blue, feeling so bad. Gonna pull up colors up over your head. Well, enough said about that. Still gotta get up in the morning. Feet on the floor, put on your clothes, get yourself out the door. Well, enough said about that. Still gotta get up in the morning. Well, enough said about that. Still gotta get up in the morning. Still. Oh, oh. Still. Got to go outside, walk down the street.
You are listening to Democracy Now! in Exile's War and Peace Report. In a minute, we're going to speak with a young woman who lost her stepmother in the World Trade Center attacks, and she's with the group Peace Action, and she'll talk about her feelings today in the wake of what took place September 11th, but also in light of the military buildup now. I just wanted to go back to Irfam Nayab. You're a Pakistani taxi driver. Where are you from originally in Pakistan?
Oh, I'm from Gujarat, Pakistan, which is part of Punjab.
What are you hearing from your family at home as the military buildup grows in that area?
Oh, my family is living here. My whole family is living here, but still I have some relatives back there. But they're also kind of scared from this war.
Can you talk about the politics of that region? I don't think a lot of people outside of that area know the politics of India, Pakistan, and what this could mean, U.S. attacks in the area.
Well, our politicians are also kind of very cooperative to the United States because we are Muslims and We hate terrorism, and we encourage it, and that's why even our politicians have close relations with the Afghans, but they are hiding Osama. That's why they are cooperating to United States. It means our politicians are encouraged with the terrorists, but only the fundamentalist Muslims are just protesting for Osama.
Bharavi Desai, you're an organizer, New York City Taxi Workers Alliance. How is this affecting your organizing?
It's had a tremendous effect on the organizing work. First of all, you know, I think as Irfat, you know, testified earlier, for many people, it's just been difficult just to leave their homes. And when they do leave their homes, there's been a great need to stay within their neighborhoods because a lot of the mosques and the community centers have been under attack. And also, you know, just to give protection to their children and their families. So it's been hard just to get people to come out to meetings, you know, when they're finding it difficult just to go out and work as it is. And when people are working, it's been under very difficult conditions, you know, under tremendous amount of fear. And I think, you know, that definitely has an effect on you in terms of how willing you are to participate in political work, which may make you feel even more vulnerable when you're already scared about being in this society. And there's a lot of fear out there in terms of the repercussions regarding the immigration laws and different civil liberties. So, you know, we're really, I feel like drivers are kind of in a state of siege right now. And yet the drivers who cannot afford to absolutely have had to go out and still work. And so many drivers I know who used to work 10 hours are now being forced to work 12 hours. Who used to work 6 days are now being forced to work 7 days. Because in the middle of all of this, you know, business has really been impacted.
And you yourself, how has your experience been walking in the streets? Do you feel safe? You're from India?
Right, I'm from India. I mean, I've had, you know, different experiences, or, you know, I've had people call me terrorist, and, you know, I had a gang of people at one time, you know, who, you know, yelled out that, that my people were responsible for this, and it was rather scary, you know, and there were other South Asians on the street, and we just kind of looked at each other with, you know, a lot of fear, and people just kind of wanting to run back inside to their homes. You know, I wear traditional Indian clothing every day, so I've had family member after family member just kind of offering me money to so I could wear jeans again for the first time in a really long time. And it's been, I think on the trains, it's been really scary. And the interesting thing is that I think, you know, because I do wear traditional clothes, and so for a lot of second generation immigrants, I think there's an assumption that I just migrated to America. And one of the, I think part of the whole divide and conquer politics that's being played out is the divide between first generation and second generation immigrants. So I've actually had a lot of incidences with second generation immigrants, you know, being very abusive toward me. And so, you know, and people kind of talking about, well, we're American. The people who did this are from the third world. You know, so there's been a lot of dynamics also just within the community that, so I think the dynamics from the broader community are definitely being reflected within the community itself.
Well, I want to thank you all very much for being with us. We've been joined by Bharavi Desai, organizer of the New York City Taxi Workers Alliance, Irfam Nayab, Pakistani cab driver, and Luis Molina, a Latino cab driver here in New York, Puerto Rican, a driver who proudly has a Puerto Rican flag on his taxi cab. Thanks very much for stopping by. As we move now to a young woman who lost her stepmother in the World Trade Center attack, as the Bush administration continues its military buildup in Central Asia, peace activists around the country are mobilizing against impending war, holding hundreds of demonstrations in the last several weeks. This weekend, more than 10,000 people converged in Washington, D.C., another 10,000 in San Francisco, and there is a major protest planned for New York this October 7th. Sunday at 3:30 in Union Square. Many people who lost loved ones in the suicide hijackings are also speaking out against Bush's plans for military retaliation, though you might not hear that part of their story as much in the mainstream media. Among them is Jennifer Rice, and she works with California Peace Action, lost her stepmother in United Airlines Flight 93, which crashed in Pennsylvania. Jennifer, welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Thank you.
Can you talk about, we talked yesterday and you were just about to go out canvassing.
Mm-hmm.
What are you doing exactly? You're going from house to house?
Yeah, I go to house and I find support of people in different areas throughout, like, either the Greater Bay Area and Northern California. We also have an office in L.A., and we have campuses that does the same thing. And I look for supportive people to basically our cause, which is right now we're working to prevent an indiscriminate retaliatory attack by our government. We would like to see them to continue to use diplomacy in response to the attacks on the 11th. And so I find supportive people to that, and I have them take action, be it become members or become letter writers, take action by calling, you know, presidential switchboard, send a switchboard, just to get them activated and vocalized. And so in a nutshell, that's pretty much what I do.
You know, in the corporate media and television, we have seen a number of members of families of loved ones lost in the World Trade Center or in the planes that went down tell their stories. But we don't see the second part, which is what they recommend. And we're finding increasingly on the War and Peace Report, the number of, I guess you could say, survivors, those that lost loved ones, saying that they don't want innocent people killed to avenge the killing of innocent people.
Yeah.
But we don't hear that as much, that part of the story. Can you tell us what Peace Action is doing around the country, the organization you're a part of?
Okay. We are actually to get that message out there, because it isn't being heard enough. We are we write opinion editorials, letters to the editors, do papers nationwide. We've been doing a lot of media work through radio and also through television. Excuse me. And I personally I was asked to take out reporters from USA Today, and so I actually took them out with me canvassing one night. And you know, we're doing a lot to get this message out to the mainstream media so that we can get it out to the mainstream America on a broader level, so that people that do feel this way, that are surrounded by people that don't, will be able to feel like they're not alone, and they can come up and speak their mind and say, look, I want a peaceful resolution. I don't want to see us go to war. And they'll know that, you know, they have the backing of a lot of people throughout the nation.
Has losing a relative changed your mind at all about U.S. foreign policy?
Oh, no, I still feel exactly the same about U.S. foreign policy. You know, working for Peace Action, I came to Peace Action for the primary purpose that, you know, they worked towards a goal of ultimate peace, right, by working to cut, you know, the waste and fraud out of the military budget, by working to cut nuclear weapons, you know, and that is something that I believe very strongly in. And then in the wake of the attacks on the 11th, coming out and just, you know, crying out for a peaceful resolution and calling upon our government to use great restraint, I felt like that was an extremely important message that really needed to come out in the wake of this. I felt more driven than ever before to do the work that I do and continue to work to make a change.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Jennifer Rice, for joining us. And for people who want to get more information on Peace Action, you can go to the web at www.peace-action.org. And the New York Taxi Workers Alliance for the segment before is 212-627-5248 for information on emergency relief funds and meetings. Democracy Now! In Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, Miranda Kennedy, Anthony Sloan, our music maestro and engineer, Errol Maitland at the helm at www.wbix.org. You can also hear us at webactive.com. Special thanks to our video team, Chase Pearson, Tony Riddle, Rick Younger, Zoe Noh, Karen Renucci, Dee Dee Halleck, Lenny Charles, Sam Delgado, Rachel Jones, Tom Poole, Deep Dish TV. Special thanks to our tech team and Downtown Community Television. Thank you to KFCF and KPFA, and of course to all our affiliate stations around the country. We are Pacifica. We're broadcasting in exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of the Band and the Fire, the studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening. From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now! In Exile. Federal agents pull the records of Arab and Muslim students on college campuses across the country as students complain of widespread discrimination in class and out. And President Bush's proposed anti-terrorism bill includes broad powers to wiretap phones, track internet communications, and prosecute anyone who knowingly harbors a suspected terrorist. We'll take a look at civil liberties as the country prepares for war. All that and more coming up on the War and Peace Report. Welcome to Democracy Now! in Exile's War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush, Prime Minister Tony Blair of Britain, have bluntly threatened Afghanistan's rulers with military attacks if they don't hand over Osama bin Laden. This is the U.S. steps up efforts to enlist international support against bin Laden by presenting classified evidence linking him to last month's suicide attacks in Washington and New York. In Brussels, NATO for the first time formally invoked a mutual defense clause obliging all 18 of its other members to aid the U.S. just as if they had been attacked themselves. The vote was taken after ministers were briefed on what a State Department spokesman called a great body of evidence implicating bin Laden's network, al-Qaeda, in the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. Several NATO countries had been pressing for information proving bin Laden's culpability, and the administration launched an intensive effort to build an extensive case. The evidence was contained in cables that the State Department sent to its ambassadors around the world Monday night. It was shared in varying degrees depending on the U.S. relationship with the host country yesterday and today. Saudi Arabia's defense minister said no troops would be allowed to use bases in his nation to launch attacks on Arabs or Muslims, according to an interview that has been published in a government-controlled newspaper. But U.S. officials said they've received tacit assurances that Saudi Arabia will allow U.S. troops to use a command center at a base in Saudi Arabia as a staging ground for military action against Osama bin Laden. About 4,500 U.S. soldiers and an undisclosed number of U.S. warplanes involved in the patrols are based at the Prince Sultan Air Base in Al-Kharj, a vast compound in a remote stretch of desert south of Riyadh, the capital. A Greyhound bus crashed today, killing six of the 38 people aboard and prompting Greyhound to halt all service nationwide as a precaution. The bus crashed after a passenger slit the driver's throat. A woman on board told a Nashville television station. Authorities said they could not confirm that. Dana Keaton of the Tennessee Department of Safety said, "We're interviewing passengers and are not saying anything more until we're sure what happened." U.S. Justice Department spokesperson said it's too early to tell if the accident was terrorist-related, but the agency didn't believe so. The bus was en route from Louisville, Kentucky to Atlanta when it crashed at 4:15 a.m. The United States may have to sacrifice the death penalty if it wants to extradite and try suspected terrorists arrested in Europe. Within a month, European Union leaders will meet with top U.S. officials to hammer out streamlined extradition procedures, but most European Union countries will likely oppose the extradition accords as long as the United States retains the death penalty. As more suspects are picked up throughout Europe, the issues of capital punishment and extradition threaten to hinder the otherwise efficient cooperation that's marked U.S. and European efforts to deal with the attacks. Currently, extradition between European nations and the United States is handled on a case-by-case basis, but countries have uniformly refused to extradite suspected criminals unless U.S. officials sign a document stipulating that the individual would not face capital punishment if convicted. And President Bush yesterday backed the creation of a Palestinian state as part of his vision for Mideast peace as he tried to rally Arab and Muslim nations for war. It's the first time Bush has publicly backed a Palestinian state since taking office, although he took pains to say the first step must be reducing Mideast violence. Bush's talk of Palestinian statehood came as he sent Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld to four key Muslim states: Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Oman, and Uzbekistan. And Israeli forces killed at least 6 Palestinians during a tank incursion into a Palestinian-ruled area of the Gaza Strip today after a raid by Hamas gunmen on a Jewish settlement that killed 2 settlers and wounded 15. The violence left a ceasefire in tatters and dealt another blow to Washington's efforts to end the second Palestinian uprising and draw Arab and Islamic nations into an anti-terror alliance. Israeli troops have killed 27 Palestinians in the last week. Both attacks were condemned by the Palestinian Authority. And the National Low Income Housing Coalition released a report concluding that the average U.S. worker must earn at least $13.80 an hour, nearly 3 times the federal minimum wage, to pay the rent on even a modest 2-bedroom apartment. The organization's annual Out of Reach report found there's no jurisdiction in the country where someone working full-time at the $5.15 an hour federal minimum wage can afford an apartment. This year, the analysis concluded the gap between a minimum wage salary and the cost of housing grew faster than before and widened virtually everywhere. And in Germany, shopkeepers in Berlin plan to black out their windows today to protest an expected neo-Nazi march on the national holiday marking the reunification of Germany. Authorities expect counter-demonstrators to greatly outnumber the estimated 1,000 rightists. And this news from Tennessee, 5,000 Nissan employees began casting ballots before dawn today on whether to unionize, a vote that bolsters the United Auto Workers Union during a period of sagging membership. A union victory would boost the United Auto Workers on another front, marking the first time the UAW would have a foothold at a U.S. auto plant fully owned by a foreign company. Marvin Gaye, Where Are We Going? Here on Democracy Now in Exile's War and Peace Report, as we break the sound barrier with this unprecedented collaboration of internet, radio, and public access TV, as well as satellite television, broadcasting the voices of dissent around the country and the world in this time of a military buildup for war. I'm Amy Goodman. Federal agents are targeting Arab students on college campuses as part of their investigation into the September 11th attacks, gathering lists of foreign nationals and combing through files. Investigators began looking at college campuses after learning some of the alleged hijackers or their accomplices were in the country on student visas. Officials at universities across the country say they've received requests from the FBI. Because of the emergency nature of the situation, schools have been ordered to waive normal privacy concerns. The U.S. Department of Education has told campuses they can release data without a subpoena or student consent when there is a health or safety emergency. At least 3 California State University campuses have turned over student records to the FBI, and federal officials have asked for details on students at all campuses. The FBI made a blanket request for the records of all 736 foreign students at the Fresno campus of California State, though at most of the campuses, they've only requested the records of 1 or 2 students. All of those records at Fresno State have been turned over. As the attacks and the FBI investigation raise concerns about the sacrifice of individual freedoms, scores of Arab foreign students have dropped out of college and left the country. Many have been called home by parents fearful of war and anti-Arab sentiment. Saudi Arabian and United Arab Emirates governments say they'll provide free airfare to students who wish to go home. We're joined now by Osama Kass, who is a finance major at California State University at Long Beach. He's 18 years old and was recently visited by the FBI. Welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Good morning.
So tell us what happened. When did they come over?
It was on Friday. They came in the morning while I wasn't here and talked to my mom and left a card for me. And when I called them back, they came at 5 o'clock, two of them. It was a very short interview for about 5 minutes. My name is Osama, so their first question was pretty funny. They asked if I spelled my name with a U or a no. And then they were asking about my birth, date of birth, place of birth. I thought they would knew that. They would know that, but they pretend to not know a lot of things, even though they do. And then they were asking me if I have heard of the Al-Qaeda organization before September 11th. I said yes. On the news when the USS Cole incident occurred. They were also asking me if I've seen any of these people that have been in the area before, especially four of the hijackers that were in this in Southern California in the past few months. I told them these names are very common, like Al Ghamdi, Nawaf. There's like 10,000 Al Ghamdis from the Gulf areas, you know. Their questions seemed very, very interesting. There was no profiling going on. It was just very, very casual. They were friendly, and I didn't really see any sort of profiling going on into the interview. Their basic concern was that some individuals might still be on the run, might still be hiding, and they might be approaching certain individuals in the community to try to get them to help them without knowing. They told me they were going to talk to me, especially because they know that I'm active and vocal in the Muslim Student Association at OCC and at Cal State Long Beach, and that the suspects that might still be hiding might be approaching some of the leaders in the community to get them to help them, like find a job, find an apartment, a place to stay, borrow some money, something like that, and that because I have a lot of contacts and I know a lot of people, I might be in contact with some of these people somehow. So it felt like they were trying to caution me. So they're trying to caution me, basically.
Will Laffey Yeomans is also on the line with us, a law student at UC Berkeley who works with Students for Justice in Palestine. It's called the Alauda Organization. Is this a typical experience? Have you been approached?
Hello. I individually have not been approached. From what I'm hearing through various listservs, that the people who are being approached from most of the stories that we're getting are kind of secondhand, not people actually on the listservs, but talking about people that they know, are mostly apolitical. It just seems like there seems to be no visible pattern as far as I can tell. I don't know if Osama's experience is a common one of him being targeted because he's being political. What I've heard is that there really is no pattern and no way to tell. In fact, our organization, which is very visible and very critical of American foreign policy, only one person so far has received a call in our organization. So it's rather unique. We do know that there's a large FBI presence in the city of Berkeley, mostly because of the presence of the Lawrence Livermore Laboratories. Also, 2 years ago when there were protests when Madeleine Albright came to speak, several of the activists who were there then and in our organization now were approached by various officials from the government, and there was a lot of interrogation and questioning then. So we sort of know that their fingers are sort of on our pulse. But as of now, not much has happened directly. We also have heard from a anonymous telephone company employee that the FBI has requested taps put and information from over 1,200 people in the Bay Area, all of them Arabic or Muslim names.
Are you yourself, Will Laffey Yeomans, Palestinian?
Yeah, I'm of mixed descent. I'm half Palestinian, half European American.
Mm-hmm. Ibrahim Hooper also joins us on the line, and he's with the Council on American Islamic Relations. Overall in this country, can you talk about the number of students who are now being questioned, the number of records that are being pulled? I mean, that's pretty interesting, these reports that, for example, at Fresno State, all the students' records were asked for and I believe were turned over.
Yeah, I mean, we obviously don't have specific information on how many and who and all that. I mean, we've been dealing mainly with the overt anti-Muslim incidents, almost 800 now that we've recorded since the attacks, and that's been our main concern, everything from, you know, taunts of Muslim school children to shooting deaths of Muslim and actually non-Muslim shop owners.
What do you recommend to people that they do in terms of the kind of dragnet that is going on in this country right now?
Well, I mean, first of all, if anybody has any information that could be remotely helpful to the investigation into these horrific attacks, we would ask people to go to the FBI and not wait for the FBI to come to them. Having said that, I mean, we don't want to throw out the civil liberties baby with the bathwater in terms of, you know, just basically, as they say, knock and talk, where they just go to everybody they can think of or anybody that's ever been mentioned as an activist or, you know, basically anybody in the Muslim community and just kind of fish for things and hope something pops up. That's a very intimidating tactic.
Will Laffey-Yeomans, can you talk about the Patriot Act of 2001, what this proposed bill says?
Yes. Well, I guess it was led by Representative John Conyers and Representative Sensenbrenner from Wisconsin, and it's basically putting together a package, a compromise package, on how to proceed with counterterrorism tactics, mostly dealing with surveillance, but generally broadening the kind of surveillance procedures that already exist. So it's actually taking a pretty low standard that the government has had before in order to, you know, put together a wiretap. And it's actually making it a lot easier for those things to be obtained. Also, it's expanding that to email and the Internet. So that right now the government will have the FBI will have access using, I guess, carnivore technology, which I admit I don't completely understand how that exactly works. But there's going to be... when it was first proposed by the administration, there was... talk of having the ability to indefinitely detain an immigrant suspected of terrorism. I think thanks to some of the bargaining that's been brought down from indefinitely to 7 days, which still has severe, I think, constitutional questions, especially because when you say suspected of terrorism, that's not necessarily a very clear kind of standard. And we've seen this before in 1996 with the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act. There was the use of secret evidence to detain people suspected of terrorism. And when after 2.5-3 years of going through this new legal process, when the evidence finally came out, it ended up being a lot of times evidence was constitutionally protected activities, like newspaper. They would have a newspaper article on an individual which said that this person was at a rally or at a banquet and gave a talk. So really what it seems to be doing is kind of expanding what the powers of the government were before in terms of surveillance, but giving them more sort of a blank check in terms of rounding people up and keeping tags on everybody. And I guess Dianne Feinstein, our senator from California, is proposing a 6-month moratorium on issuing new visas for foreign students, as well as having more extensive background checks, and is also talking about developing an electronic surveillance system for foreign students. And I guess the logic behind it, as was mentioned in this program, was that some of the alleged terrorists came in on student visas, which is problematic because tourist visas and business visas are pretty much perhaps easier to acquire.
Well, Lafayette Yeomans, we have to break for stations to identify themselves, but I want to ask you if you believe that records have been turned over by UC Berkeley, though the university says they have not been. Will Lafayette Yeomans, a law student, UC Berkeley, Ibrahim Cooper is a spokesperson for the Council on American Islamic Relations, and Usama Kass is a student at California State University at Long Beach. We come back from our break. We will finish with them and then hear from two leading constitutional scholars on civil rights in this country, David Cole and Michael Ratner. Stay with us.
I will not obey. Give us the minds of your children to learn the substance of books we have not yet burned. But can they read the sky for rain? What can one say? I will not obey. Soon all tyrants will feel our impatience. We choose to create our own combinations. I was always willing to agree. What can one say? I will not obey. The essence of contract is agreement, not coercion or obedience. And agreement is sacred. What can one say? I will not obey. There are so few wars of people's liberation, for the people have so seldom risen. Only the armed faction, listen, the armed faction lies. They recreate the state through their action. When the people rise, it is not they, but the state which dies. I sing this song for the prisoners' release, most of all now for the new state police. You see, the guns have changed hands again. What can one say?
Utah Phillips, I Will Not Obey, from his CD with Ani DiFranco, fellow workers, here on Democracy Now! In Exile's War and Peace Report. This is Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. As we finish up our discussion with Will Lafayette Yeomans, UC Berkeley law student with Students for Justice in Palestine, Usama Kass, a student at California State University, Long Beach, and Ibrahim Hooper, spokesperson for Council on American-Islamic Relations. Will Lafayette Yeomans, do you know if the UC Berkeley has turned over any records to the FBI of Arab or Palestinian students?
I haven't heard as such, and I think part of the nature of the problem is that there isn't much transparency in the whole process. So we really doubt that we really will ever know about the nature of the surveillance on our community, and we don't think the university, especially here in Berkeley, would be very proud to admit that. So there's really no way to know. I think that the general sentiment among fellow activists here is that the worst is sort of yet to be seen, because the ball is starting to get, you know, rolling. And I'm sorry.
Ibrahim Hooper, as you're documenting two things, one is attacks on Arab Americans and Muslims in this country, and the other is this kind of surveillance. Overall, your impression of this is going to get worse?
I think it peaked momentarily, but I'm afraid that when the actual fighting starts, and it looks like it may start soon, that it will pick up again. I mean, we have this another incident this morning with a bus crash in Tennessee, I believe, where they're hinting that it could be related to these kinds of things. So, you know, as each incident occurs, I think we're going to see spikes in these kinds of backlash incidents.
Usama Kass, are you going to be changing your lifestyle at all right now, what you do, where you walk, at the California State University at Long Beach, in light of what is happening? You have been questioned, but now presumably, the FBI, you don't expect them to return, do you?
No, I don't expect them to return to me. As a matter of fact, if my lifestyle is going to be changing, it's going to be changed for the better. I felt the sense from a lot of students and a lot of teachers that this is unifying everybody. There's a few incidents here and there, but the majority of the people are very supportive. I know that for a fact that Cal State Long Beach, at least 40 Kuwaiti or people from the Emirates left to their countries just last week. And there's like 10 more that are planning to leave within the next week. That's just 40 at one university. There's been like two incidents against two of the students outside the campus, but nothing on the campus. And I think that things are actually getting better as far as the FBI is concerned. The FBI is getting better in their interrogation of people, in their interviewing of people. The first week, a lot of the people were saying that they were asking them about their political views and profiling them, basically. And now, a lot of the people that are getting interviewed, like me, I think I've asked some people, and they told me that the interviews are just more like, you know, here's what's happening, be aware, and that's it.
Where's your family originally from?
From Syria. Mm-hmm. I was born in New Jersey.
Well, I want to thank you all very much for being with us. Usama Khas from California State University, Long Beach. Ibrahim Hooper, Council on American Islamic Affairs and Relations. And Will Laffey Yeomans, law student at UC Berkeley. As we continue on this issue, the theme of civil liberties, the detention of some 500 people as part of the FBI investigation into the September 11th attacks and new legislation that would give law enforcement expanded powers have raised serious concerns for civil rights groups. There have been teach-ins all over the country, among them yesterday at New York Law School with Michael Ratner, with the Center for Constitutional Rights, and David Cole, who is co-author of Terrorism and the Constitution, Sacrificing Civil Liberties in the Name of National Security. We'll go first to the talk of David Cole.
The attacks of September 11th violated every principle of human decency, of civilized society, and of the rule of law. They have made us all vulnerable in ways that most of us have never experienced, and most of us thought we never would experience. They require us, among other things, to reevaluate our intelligence and law enforcement capabilities to respond to the threat of terrorism, to ensure that all of us remain safe in our homeland. But in assessing how we can respond to the fight against terrorism, how we can respond to the threat, I think we have to respond in ways that are measured, that are effective, and that are consistent with our own deepest commitments to constitutional principle. Nothing tests commitments to principle like terror. And we are all afraid. Historically, in times of fear, we have often, unfortunately, overreacted. In World War I, we locked up people for speaking out against the war, many of them immigrants. In World War II, we locked up or interned 110,000 citizens and immigrants solely because of their Japanese ancestry. In the McCarthy era, we made it a crime merely to be a member of the Communist Party. So that history suggests that we have to be careful and cautious about how we react in a moment of fear. At the time that those actions were taken, they were deemed reasonable. They were all upheld as constitutional by the Supreme Court of the United States. And it's now, in hindsight, we recognize that they were mistakes, but at the time, they seemed reasonable. So we have to be careful about what may seem reasonable now. There has been no showing that I've seen yet that the reason that we missed the conspiracy to engage in the September 11th attacks was because the government lacked sufficient power and authority to conduct surveillance or to target suspected terrorists in our country. More likely, it seems to me, that it was the result of a failure of coordination among the various intelligence agencies. We have a number of intelligence and law enforcement agencies. They're different bureaucracies. They have turf battles. They don't share information particularly effectively. And a lack of resources, particularly with respect to INS, particularly with respect to border control types of issues. Yet, most of what the Bush administration is seeking in its proposed legislation to respond to the threat of terrorism is not directed at these difficult problems of how to resolve turf struggles, how to coordinate our responses, but rather are simply designed to give the government more power. And so I ask, is it measured as a response to the threat of terrorism to impose guilt by association on immigrants? Today, the INS can detain, expel any alien, no matter how long he or she has been living here, who engages in any kind of terrorist activity, facilitates any terrorist activity, plans, conspires to engage in any terrorist activity. That's not far enough for the Bush administration. They now want to make it a deportable offense to merely provide support to a terrorist organization. And they define terrorist organization as any organization that has ever engaged in terrorist activity, and they define terrorist activity as any use of a weapon or other dangerous device with intent to endanger person or property. Now, think about that. Any use of a weapon with intent to endanger person or property. If an immigrant gets involved in a barroom brawl, breaks a bottle, and threatens somebody with it, he's a terrorist. If a husband and wife get into a domestic dispute and the wife picks up a knife and threatens her husband with it, she is a terrorist. All right, this definition of terrorism goes beyond anything that ordinary, reasonable people understand as terrorism. They essentially would make every crime of violence a terrorist activity. They would then make deportable anyone who supports any organization who has ever engaged in such use of force. That means any group that has ever been engaged in a civil war. That means that someone who gave a donation to the African National Congress today would be deportable because 15 years ago, the African National Congress fought apartheid with both violent and peaceful, lawful means, even though the support today would not possibly in any way further terrorist activity because the ANC is not engaged in terrorist activity. There's no requirement that the alien support have any connection to any kind of terrorist activity, and indeed an alien would be deportable if he was providing support in the interest of furthering peace and countering violence. So an Irish immigrant today who was in favor of the peace process and sought to further that by providing peacemaking training to the IRA would be deportable as a terrorist because the IRA has engaged in terrorism and the statute makes it a deportable offense to provide any kind of support, including volunteering your time, for any purpose whatsoever to any organization that has engaged in terrorist activity. Is that measured? Is it measured to give the Attorney General unilateral authority to detain indefinitely suspected terrorists? The Attorney General has been seeking the power to certify that he has reasonable grounds to believe that someone is engaged in terrorist activity, and then to detain that person indefinitely. Whether or not the person is ultimately found to be deportable or not, even immigrants who are ultimately found to be not deportable, to have a right to remain in the United States under the Bush proposal, they would be subject to permanent indefinite detention as long as the Attorney General says that he considers them a threat. Is it measured to resurrect ideological exclusion? Under the Bush proposal, we would bar entry to aliens based upon pure speech. Pure speech. That's something we did in the McCarran-Walter Act in the 1950s, but we repudiated that in 1990 when Congress repealed the McCarran-Walter Act, and we said that kind of exclusion for pure speech is inconsistent with our notion that we are a free country in which we can tolerate ideas that we dislike, apparently no longer. The Bush administration bill would also expand the government's authority to conduct wiretaps without probable cause of any criminal activity in criminal investigations by using as a kind of end run around the probable cause requirement the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. And although the Bush administration has not been seeking it, in formal terms, many citizens apparently today favor the response of ethnic profiling. There have been studies that have shown that before September 11th, 80% of the American public thought racial profiling was wrong. After September 11th, 60 to 65% of the American public think ethnic profiling is justified as long as it's directed against Arabs and Muslims. Now, one set of questions you can ask about this, these responses, is are they consistent with our principles? And I think clearly they are not. They are inconsistent with our commitment to political freedom. They're inconsistent with our commitment to treating individuals on their own footing as individuals and not based on their group identity. And they're inconsistent with our commitment to equality. They, in effect, trade other people's liberties, namely immigrants and Arabs and Muslims, for our security. Will these measures, in fact, make us more secure? I have my doubts, and I'll give two examples that suggest that they may not. The examples are Israel and England. Israel has had a very serious problem with terrorism for a very long time. How have they responded? Guilt by association. They make it a crime to be a member of various terrorist organizations. Incommunicado interrogation, something that we hold to be unconstitutional. Use of force to extract confessions, collective punishment, and assassination of suspected terrorists. Has this made Israel a safer country? I think not. I think, in fact, what it has done is caused more and more extreme responses from the Palestinian side. England had the same experience with respect to the IRA. They also engaged in guilt by association. They authorized internment without charges. They barred the IRA from speaking on public television. And all of these measures simply made the IRA more sympathetic and more energized. And they didn't begin to reduce the threat of terrorism until they started to negotiate through the peace process. Justice Louis Brandeis wrote 75 years ago that fear breeds repression, repression breeds hate, and hate menaces stable government. I think that's a very important lesson to remember, that in a sense, stability and security are consistent with and dependent upon freedom. If people are free to express their disagreements in peaceful ways, they are less likely to do so in more violent ways. In addition, it seems to me, you can ask whether guilt by association and ethnic profiling are likely to be effective, and I think they're both likely to be particularly ineffective for two reasons. One is that by painting with a broad brush, by treating people as guilty or suspect based not on who they are and what they've done, but based on the color of their skin or the groups or persons with whom they're associated, we will inevitably ensnare many, many innocent people. Many, many innocent people. And secondly, in engaging in these kinds of tactics, these kind of broad brush tactics, which will be and have been directed at Arabs and Muslims by and large, we risk the danger of alienating the Arab and Muslim communities. And if, in fact, the FBI believes that there are true threats, true terrorist threats within the Arab and Muslim communities, doesn't it make more sense to try to build ties to the Arab and Muslim community, to work together with the community, to rely on the millions and millions of law-abiding, peace-loving Arabs and Muslims among us to help us to identify any true threats, rather than to engage in broad brush, guilt by association, and ethnic profiling that is only going to make it more difficult for us to distinguish the true threats from the innocent among them?
David Cole, professor of law at Georgetown University, speaking about civil liberties. When we come back from our break, we will be going to Michael Ratner. David Cole was speaking at a symposium yesterday at Columbia Law School in Manhattan. You're listening to Democracy Now! In Exile's War and Peace Report. Back in a minute.
Those maintaining status quo martyrs who may come and go, you'll be swallowed up alive, my changes will repeat themselves. History books piled on the shelves. Students ask, who will our great ones be? It shall be we.
The time will come. Elaine White. You're listening to Democracy Now! In Exile's War and Peace Report as we move on to a speech by Michael Ratner at Columbia Law School yesterday. He's with the Center for Constitutional Rights on civil liberties in this military buildup.
Hello, everybody. David mentioned that I was his mentor, but in fact, after he finished his first brief as a law student for me, I was no longer his mentor. I was his student, essentially. So he's just been a terrific lawyer for a long time, and I've really appreciated working with him. David and I, in our early days at the center, along with another friend of mine who I still work with a lot, Professor Jules Lobel at University of Pittsburgh Law School, have basically brought cases against every single war the United States has fought, really since the days of Vietnam. On some illegality or other, whether war powers resolution or the Constitution. And the question that I've been struggling with for this week, or the last 3 weeks, is this a different situation? Is this a war, the one we're contemplating, or the use of military force, one that I would approve of? And I remember in my opposition with Jules to the war in Iraq, Alexander Coburn wrote me a note saying, you know, Michael, even leftists dial 911 sometimes. And it's an appropriate comment, and it has made me struggle a lot with the question. And it's particularly made me struggle because I live downtown and have been very affected in many, many ways by what happened. I was jogging by the building when I saw the plane go in. My brother was in 7 World Trade Center. I got a note last week to attend the funeral of my children's soccer coach, and the kids were supposed to wear their uniforms. So living downtown gives you a sense, first of all, of obviously wanting to stop this, to never have it happen again, and to punish the people who did it. The other feeling it gave me was of how absolutely horrible terrorism, war, the killing of people is, and how what those, the little girl at my school, who lost her father, who's in second grade, that kid has lost her father forever. And just like, unfortunately and sadly, people around the world have lost parents forever, whether that be in Israel or Palestinians or in Lebanon or in Cambodia. And what it did really, in a way, thinking like that actually deepened my resolve that we have to try and find alternatives to the use of military force. Whether there are any in this case, I am not sure yet, but I would like to think that at this point, we don't want to kill more people, and the course we're embarked on, I've concluded after a lot of self-struggle, is not really really the right one. I think the consequences, really, of a war right now, or the use of military force we're thinking about, could be absolutely horrendous. And I still think, at least in the short run, there are some alternatives. In the long run, I'm sure there are alternatives, and they just have to deal with root causes and a lot of other issues we can talk about. But even in the short run, I think there is an alternative. Because I'm a lawyer, and if we were ever thinking, some people have mentioned, oh, why don't you sue to stop this war? I want to put this in a legal context. Congress passed a resolution which essentially gave the president as much power as he wants. I'm critical of the resolution because it doesn't name any country, organization, or person. It allows him essentially to attack anybody he wants in his own discretion. It has no time limit. It doesn't require him to go back to Congress with any evidence of any country that he wants to attack or any organization he wants to attack. It's really open-ended. And I don't think that's, whatever we think about the use of force here, I don't think that's a way to run a democracy in which Congress the people through their Congress should have some more direction about the war. Is it illegal? Unlikely. The second thing you can look at is the UN. Obviously, any use of force, except in self-defense, is to be authorized by the United Nations. You could make an argument here that this is basically retaliation, what the U.S. wants to do, but the U.S. would have a pretty good argument, I think, saying it's self-defense, that there were a series of attacks, assuming we have evidence of this, a series of attacks on the U.S. By Al-Qaeda or whatever organization they decide they have evidence against, or they find they have evidence, and that those attacks might or very well might continue. And they can make a self-defense argument in this case that I think would be hard to win. Now, even though they can make a self-defense argument, that doesn't mean that they can simply, without going to the UN to use force, go on forever without the UN doing something. And in fact, in this case, the United States did go to the UN, and the UN passed a series of resolutions. Those resolutions have a number of steps in them about freezing bank accounts, turning over, they used a loose word in this particular year, terrorists. They had one a couple of years ago about bin Laden. So they have gone to the UN, and what Article 51 really says is you can use self-defense until the Security Council has taken measures to protect international peace and security. You could make an argument here that the U.S., having gone to the UN, can't go off on its own and run a coalition. It's in the Security Council's hands. It's an argument. What the resolutions, though, say, each of those resolutions reaffirms the right of countries to use self-defense. And considering that the U.S. probably authored most of those resolutions, that it's unlikely that argument would prevail. Because we're in a law school, I wanted to address that. It's not, I think, the central issue right now, although I do think UN control of force is a central issue. I want to talk about why, after really a lot of reflection, I think the use of military force here, the way it's contemplated, and I think more than, and that, of course, it depends on scale, and it may depend on, in some people's mind, on scale. Is it going to be small commando raids that try and kill bin Laden, or is it going to be something bigger than that? And people may have varying opinions about its use. I don't think it can be small commando raids. I don't think that's possible, and I don't think that's what's contemplated. If I look at the reasons, in my discussions with people, it's pretty clear that a lot of people have good reasons against war in this case. And then one thing they always say, well, what are the alternatives, Michael? And those, as I said, I'll talk to. There's at least 7 or 8 good reasons I can think right now, and people can come up with more. But one of them is, I think the use of military force is going to make us less safe, certainly going to make us less safe in New York and make the world less safe. And I think if you look at the Times today, to me, was incredibly frightening. If you look at the articles today they're talking about in Pakistan, of what's going on in Pakistan, with essentially hundreds of, I can read you the section, hundreds of, last Friday, in a drama repeated in hundreds of towns and cities, mullahs at the Red Mosque followed the gentle chanting of afternoon prayers with frenzied threats of violence. Death to America, let Americans come to be buried. Pakistan is very, very divided over what's going on here. The general in charge of it has basically said the U.S. put a gun to his head and essentially said, we're going to destroy you unless you go with us. But the amount of hate that a military action of the sort that I believe is contemplated will engender in the Mideast or in this section of the world is very, very serious. That's Pakistan and Indonesia. If you read the article yesterday, there's people going through the streets trying to sweep all Americans out of Indonesia, volunteering to fight in Afghanistan. So I think that one thing is that I think this will make us less safe. I think David's example of Israel is right. I don't think Israelis, because of the way they've reacted to terrorism, feel any safer, in fact, probably less safe than they have felt in decades. And I think we in New York living here probably should feel less safe. In fact, Ashcroft, unless he was using it, which may be, just to puff his proposals, basically said, with military attacks, we should fear more terrorism. So big thing to me here is it makes us less safe. Secondly, I think it's going to destabilize other countries, whether that be Pakistan or Saudi Arabia or other countries that have populations that are in struggle over a number of issues. And I think there's a strong chance of destabilization. The Times addresses that, again saying, America runs the danger of setting off a cataclysm in a place where civil violence is a likely bet and nuclear weapons exist. Again, we're talking about Pakistan. Third, I think the process they're doing is unlikely to stop bin Laden or kill him, capture him, and unlikely to eliminate the terrorist network. First of all, the last time we tried this, when Clinton lodged missiles into Afghanistan, American intelligence was not good enough so that they could actually kill him. Secondly, if you believe what you read in the papers, 37 countries have apparently cells of al-Qaeda. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But it doesn't seem that an attack on Afghanistan is actually going to help eliminate that. The Times also said there's 11,000 people around the world in the network. Again, I don't think an attack on Afghanistan is going to help that. Fourth, what the U.S. is doing here is requiring terrible trade-offs. Think about what we've had to do. With Indonesia, for example. All of a sudden now, Indonesia, which activists have been fighting against giving military aid to for years, all of a sudden now, we have to make a deal to give Indonesia military aid, and we know what Indonesia does with that military aid. In some way, the war against terrorism, the way it's been framed in this country, is like the war against communism. We don't care what kind of government you have. We don't care how you're repressing human rights. If you're with us on the war against terrorism, we'll let you do whatever you want, essentially, to your own populations. A very, very dangerous precedent. Fifth, and this is shadowy, but they still haven't come up with the evidence about bin Laden. And I think that's actually quite serious. You know, we did bomb a chemical plant in Sudan. We thought it was a chemical plant. It was a pharmaceutical plant. We have never shown the evidence about that. I think countries are beginning to demand the evidence. I just happened to read the Cy Hirsch piece in the New Yorker yesterday, and it said, on September 23rd, Secretary of State Powell told a television interviewer, "We will put before the world, the American people, a persuasive case showing bin Laden was responsible for the attacks. But the widely anticipated white paper could not be published," the Justice Department official said, "for lack of hard facts. There was not enough to make a sale." Now, I don't know whether bin Laden was involved in this or not. I don't know who was involved. But I do think going after it will alienate more and more people unless you can show them the evidence before you go around bombing and killing people. Sixth, this is a tragedy that's already begun to happen, and that's the refugee situation in Afghanistan. The incredible broad threats of war that have come out of our government have created thousands and thousands of refugees in Afghanistan. They're heading into the mountains. There's a winter coming in a few weeks. They're trying to lift humanitarian aid in, but it's estimated it could produce as many as 1.5 million new refugees in a country that already has 1.5 million refugees. So we're going to kill many, many people by this major threat of war. Lastly, and of course something we all think about because I think about it living downtown, is the innocents that will be killed in any campaign. And that's something we all feel very strongly about. Clearly to me, there's a huge chance of some very, very bad things happening if we go to full war. The question people then ask me, well, what's my alternative? And I tell you, short run, we've all been put in a situation where a situation that's been festering, some would say 50 years, some would say 100 years, some would say more. Short run, it's too much almost to expect answers from our country, much less from us. But at least in the short run, we have to come up with something that can at least, I think, begin to steer us away. And there has been, obviously, since the announcement 2 weeks ago or the Bush speech on the 20th, some movement by the United States away from at least the kind of war that you were thinking about when he was giving his speech. And that's partly because of what the European countries have done. I mean, I think they've made some of the points that I've made. Other people have. And there's certainly a lessening. I don't think a lessening to the extent that it's going to protect us enough, but a lessening. The proposal that I and a number of other people have made are, first of all, to treat this as a crime against humanity and not as an act of war, and treat it as a criminal act, and get the perpetrators, however you get them, basically with an arrest and trial, which is the best way. If you can't, there's other ways to do that, but basically treat it as a crime against humanity. Secondly, go to the Security Council with that. Ask the Security Council for an ad hoc court, much like the courts that we've done in Rwanda and for Bosnia and former Yugoslavia, that can try the perpetrators of September 11th. It has the advantage, of course, in much of the world, of at least making it look more neutral, and it's a world trying to combat what happened, and not just a United States-led force going in, even with all of our allies. Third, obviously give that court the power to arrest, extradite, and try the people. And then people, of course, say to me, well, what if the people just don't show up? Well, I mean, if you can't get the people. The answer to that is, first of all, we don't know until we really set that up. And lastly, which is something I think, is you could actually establish a UN force, to arrest the people under real UN authority. It's provided for in the Charter. To go and actually, if necessary, use force to get the people. but you would have to present evidence to the court and get them. Is it a perfect alternative? No. In the present and current situation, I don't see any perfect alternatives. It's a short-run suggestion or solution, because I think that what we're facing on the other side is so dramatically bad, and the consequences are so horrible. The two other things for the long run seem pretty clear to me. One is the U.S. has to understand that it's part of a world of nations and not a superpower that can engage in unilateral actions. That's true both even of the force that's now being put together, which should be under the authority of the U.N., but it's even more true, really, or similarly true of the U.S. actions that we've seen over the last few years. Obviously, all of a sudden, the U.S. is paying its U.N. dues. It's recognizing that at this point, what it does is when it needs the U.N., it goes and pays its dues, uses the U.N. a little bit like a fig leaf and goes on, and then forgets it the next day. We can't have that situation. We really have to have the U.S. as part of the U.N. And that includes, if it's going to use force, if my ideas and others like me don't prevail, at least go to the U.N. and use a real U.N. force and not a fig leaf for the United States. Second,
you've been listening to Michael Ratner with the Center for Constitutional Rights speaking yesterday at Columbia Law School. And that does it for our program today. If you'd like to email us, send your mail to mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. And we're curious, if you're watching on cable access, perhaps on MNN, Channel 34 in New York, tomorrow Friday, we'll be on Channel 56 at Time Warner, public access in New York. We're also broadcasting at WFMU 91.1 FM in New York every evening at 7 o'clock. We're broadcasting on Pacifica affiliates around the country and Pacifica station KPFA, thanks so much for that, as well as KFCF in Fresno. Democracy Now in Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, and Miranda Kennedy. Anthony Sloan is our music maestro and engineer. Errol Maitland's at the helm at www.wbix.org, where you can hear the program twice daily. Also on webactive.com. You can also go to our website at democracynow.org. Special thanks to our video team, Chase Pearson, Tony Riddle, Orlando Richards, Rick Youngers, who I know, Karen Renucci, Dee Dee Halleck, Lenny Charles, Tom Poole, Rachel Jones, and Angela Alston. Thanks to our tech team, courtesy of New York Independent Media Center, and to our hosts here at Downtown Community Television, John Alpert and Keiko Suno. You can see the program also at Dish Network. That's channel 9415 Free Speech TV. That's channel 9415 on Dish Network Free Speech TV. And you can go to freespeech.org. We're broadcasting from the historic firehouse of Engine 31, just blocks from Ground Zero, from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of the Band and the Fired, the studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now! in Exile's War and Peace Report.